Hello, and welcome to another episode of Thinking Critically, a D&D discussion. My name is Danilo, a D&D savant, and I like all kinds of games and the crunchy mechanics that make them tick. You can find me on Twitter at Danilo_D&D, and on Instagram and Facebook at ThinkingCriticallyDND. Today, in quite possibly the most audacious crossover event of 2020, I'm joined by Nathan Briggs, the DM of our Dungeons, Dice and Dudes Actual Play podcast. Nathan, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure thing. So I am a content creator, and I have been playing D&D. I looked it up specifically for this since August 2018, and then about 3 months later, I ran my first one-shot, and then so I've been DMing a campaign. I think it was the beginning of this year, or just like December of last year. And so far, it's seemingly going well, so...
If you're talking about Dungeons, Dice and Dudes, it's going very well.
Yeah, it's a fun time most of the time when I'm not killing everybody.
I think considering you've had two or three guests that are dropping in and out, I think that's done rather seamlessly. So it's going rather well. Okay, so thank you for that. The topic of today is macro. So Nathan, what does the word macro mean to you?
Well, I mean, apparently not the same as what it means to anybody else on the internet, because when I tried to look up like, oh, possible talking points for like macro subjects, it was all just like macro keys for Roll20. So I was like, that doesn't help. But for me personally, macro is just the bigger picture stuff, the story of a subject or D&D as a whole. It's kind of, instead of getting into character details and things like that, who is that character on like a wider scale sort of thing. It's just really kind of pulling back that lens and looking at everything overall.
Mm-hmm. So if we start with about as macro as you can get, then all the way outside of the table, outside of the DMs, outside of the players, we can go all the way up to the bigger picture of D&D in society, right? You know, its place in popular culture, which is about as high up as you can get. What do you think about that? You know, where it sits in popular culture, you know, whether it's a force for good, those kind of things.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be completely honest, when Rob, who has been on your podcast, who ran our other campaign, which is how we first met, I did kind of, for lack of a better term, kind of rolled my eyes, because I was like, oh, D&D, like... oh, whatever. Sure thing, I guess. Because he literally was just like, hey, I played with my friends. I kind of want to get something to continue going here in Southampton. And so I was like, cool, I'll do one session with you as like a favor, and then I'll bounce because that shit sounds lame. Even though I love RPGs.
Now, look at you now, Nathan. Look at you now. Oh, mate. Eating those words.
Like, so much money has been poured into D&D. It's unbelievable. But because I wanted to be at least somewhat adequate at it, I was like, okay, well, let me do the research. So I think the first thing that I watched was Harmon's Quest to kind of get an idea of how to play. And I was like, okay, well, this is just basically, it's a bunch of comedians. They get together. They are playing D&D, but they're not really telling you anything about it. And then, as I'm sure happens with a lot of people, I then found Critical Role. And that's when I really kind of found out that, like, the true scope of what D&D can be. So for most people, especially before Stranger Things, I think you'd probably look at or hear D&D and you think, oh, sweaty guys in like a basement with a neck beard with like Dorito cheese on their fingers being really weird and creepy. Unless, I mean, you've seen Community or IT Crowd. Both of those do like a really good job of portraying it.
Is that some kind of sex thing? Far from it.
It's quite the opposite. But as I say, it wasn't until Critical Role where I was like, oh man, this thing is like amazing. It's a form of storytelling. It's a form of like acting. It's improv class. It's therapy for people. It's like, it's so many things. and it's just amazing. Whenever I talk about it, I get super passionate about it because of how much it can encapsulate.
Yeah, I think it'll be a good discussion because you are, as you've just said, like quite a huge fan of that particular podcast. I am not quite so much. I've watched maybe 60% of season one and I enjoyed it when I had the time to enjoy it. I think I watched the first maybe one episode of campaign two, and I get what it's trying to do, and I get that it's a, you know, it's good to keep it simple. However, there are a couple of things, the most simplest of which is it's a time sink, right? I don't really have 3 hours a week to watch somebody else play personally without it even being background noise. There's a podcast, my only podcast I listen to, which is a D&D podcast, and you know those episodes are usually 1 to 2 hours, and even that I find myself who's that NPC, and and then I'm already drawn out a little bit. So I think it asks quite a lot of the listeners. I have to say Critical Role is asking a lot, and you know, you could lay that comparison to say something like Lord of the Rings, which asks you to sit down for 3 hours times by three and has all sorts of fluff and lore to it. And you know, people don't get on with Lord of the Rings for the same reason of that. Oh, God, I really don't want to watch a 3 hour film. Yeah. And imagine watching a 3 hour film every week for 3 years.
I mean, there's definitely people that do that.
Oh, for sure, yeah. The other thing I wanted to say is that I feel that I don't think it's a good place to start because it sets wrong expectations. So I like that you already had a pool maybe of you know, 2 or 3 other examples before you started with Critical Role.
Yeah.
A couple of the players in my game, which are brand spanking newbies, such as yourself from in the past, obviously all roads lead to Critical Role now. Like you can't really Google D&D
without
seeing something related to it. So they are like, oh, okay, this looks popular. I have no idea of how popular it is, but I'll give it a listen. You know, like if someone Googled video games and it was League of Legends was probably the first thing that pops up, they'd go, oh, this is a video game. And in that company, in Matt's defense, they've said before, like, every game's different, every table's different, don't use us as a standard because your DM is his own DM and so on and so on. But if you watch an episode, you're not getting that layer of advice, especially to newbies who don't even know that games are different.
Yeah. I mean, obviously they haven't intended it to be this way, but when you have set yourself up as being the biggest example of D&D on the internet, there's going to be comparisons that people draw, and it's always going to be the first port of call for new people because all you have to do is type in D&D and it's pretty much Critical Role that pops up. And obviously I don't want this to kind of devolve into just us talking about Critical Role because that's not what this is about, but it's always a good touch point. And I feel like what will probably end up happening for a lot of people is, for me, I started off loving it because I somehow have found a way to watch the first campaign twice and keep up to date with this one. But I have now gotten to a point where I am now watching it for the story because of how well that world is crafted and the overarching storylines. I'm no longer watching it for the fights or the gameplay mechanics because it is done differently to how I would do it. And so I found myself being a lot more critical of it, pardon the pun, but it's still a really good example of storytelling, which, I mean, for a lot of people, I think that's kind of why you listen to a D&D podcast, because you listen to the storytelling, the people kind of, you know, improvising their characters and the RP more than anything else, for the most part. I'm sure there's outliers that are like, no, I really just want to listen to them because I really like them as people, which is always the way.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, if there was any episode of this podcast that we were going to talk about Critical Role, it's going to be this one because of its ubiquity in popular culture. It's the golden child, right? It's the classic success story, rags to riches kind of thing. So you can't fault it for that.
Yeah. Specifically going from a homebrew campaign, as everybody does, and then kind of being jettisoned into the stratosphere of being just amazing. This is how you do D&D, which is unhealthy.
Yeah.
It's going to happen.
Yeah. And then when my, obviously my new players are like, oh, I've watched this thing called Critical Role. And I'm like, man, you don't appreciate the weight of those words that I just found this thing online, this little thing that, you know, I don't know if you've heard of it, Dan. Like, I have. And then, you know, I can't help but wince a little and think, oh man, they're going to be disappointed.
Well, I mean, it's unfortunate, but I mean, they've come out multiple times and saying, you know, as you've already pointed out, you know, this is how we run our games. This is me as a DM, you know, respect your own DM, your game's going to be different. Mm-hmm. I think I'm quite lucky as a DM that I am the fan in my campaign. My players, you know, some of them have watched a couple of episodes, but nobody's invested as much time as me. So if there were any kind of expectations, that's coming from myself. That's kind of something that I'm putting onto me in terms of, okay, well, Matt Mercer will pull a story thread from like episode 5 and pull it out at like episode 100. And so for me, that's something that I like, that's a really good form of storytelling that kind of helps kind of reward people that have invested in their story.
Yeah.
That's something that I want to be able to utilize in my campaigns. Nobody else is coming to the table being like, oh God, this goblin that's friends with my sister better come back up at some point later down the road. But if I can do that, then again, that's something that I'd like to be able to do.
Mm-hmm. I think we'll talk about long form campaigns a bit later on, because I've got some thoughts on that as well. And that's probably one thing we'll agree on quite heavily. I'm lucky in that I was quick to jump on those expectations and say, yeah, you know, by all means, watch that. But let me tell you, that ain't how they all are. That is literally like the best in the world. That's like seeing, you know, a Maserati drive around the track and being like, oh, okay, all cars are like that. Cool. I'll just pop down to the local Ford dealership.
Yep.
Well, what do you mean it can't do 0 to 60 in half a second?
You're talking about cars, mate. You've lost me now.
well, that's you've reached my limit of car knowledge. Yeah. Maserati and Ford. There we go. We're done. 0 to 60 in half a second might be completely impossible, so I've probably shown my ignorance to
all the car fans are gonna anyway. Like just descend on this episode. What's this guy talking about?
Oh, that's cool. So I've managed to piss off Critical Role fans and car fans within the first half hour. Dope. Cool.
Hey, you're doing well, mate.
Well, on that wave, another thing I've alluded to in a couple of episodes in offhand comments, and I wanted to get your thoughts on it. So when I started this journey, I started with Twitter as my social network platform of choice.
Right.
And I don't know whether it's inherent with Twitter's user base or not, but I got the impression with D&D that it's this almost sacrosanct thing, and that no ill will can be put towards it. So as you said, back in the past, it had a very negative perception.
Yeah.
It was this, you know, satanic nerd thing that only losers did. Which is funny, because in an earlier episode with Ian, when he talked about his experience playing, you know, second edition way back when, he was like, man, this was great. We had 6 weeks off, summer holidays, and me and my friends would just play for like a week straight. And it was dope and it was fun and we had loads of fun. Contrast that with a negative perception at the time. It's a weird juxtaposition. But anyway, so now it's transferred from that into, I don't know, I just find it weird. I have a personal kind of weird dissonance between all the horror stories and all the questions you read online of, you know, especially on Reddit, where people are like, this is garbage, or, oh, my player punched me. How do I deal with that at the table?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, fucking, I don't know, call them, like, punch him back or call the police? I don't know. Why are you talking about this in a D&D context? Like, you get so many of these questions, but the moment, you know, I feel scared to say to somebody like, that's not very good, or maybe you should do it this other way, or it just feels so defensive. I don't know if you've got any thoughts or knowledge on that from your experience.
Yeah, I mean, as a Twitch streamer, I kind of feel like I need to be fairly present on social media, but 100%, if I'm ever writing a tweet, as an example, yesterday I wrote a tweet that was pretty critical against an ability that a Grave Cleric can use, which is like Sentinel at Death Door, which is essentially an ability where if you're within a certain range, you can cancel a natural 20. And even whilst writing it, I was like, oh man, I'm probably going to get so much grief for this. And I think it's just because where D&D means so much in so many different ways to so many people, it's very much defended by a lot of people, regardless of the manner in which you are coming to kind of criticizing it, be it a valid point or not. People are kind of blinded by that because of how much it means to them. It's hard for them to say or to think of it as like, okay, well, this person is just, they have a point of view that is maybe different to mine. They just see it as an attack on something that has quite possibly helped them deal with some sort of personal trauma or has kind of helped them come out of their shell. And, you know, I'm sure there's fans out there that aren't like that. But as a whole, on Twitter, it is quite difficult to say anything negative about D&D. And I completely understand why. I mean, as long as you know that you have positive intentions, that you're not just trying to be... Are we allowed to curse on here?
Well, both of us already have.
Oh, right, yeah. So, as long as you understand you're not like trying to be an arsehole or just being argumentative, then it doesn't matter if people come after you, because there's probably going to be at least a small portion of people like, I mean, he's got a point though, right?
So I went to a Sam Harris talk many moons ago, and one thing he said before, you know, imagine the worst possible state a human being could be in, and you've set a precedent there, and then imagine the utopian state a human being could be in, and you've got the best and worst, and humanity should always be trying to push from left to right, and the same can be applied to everything. And here's this weird duality again, in that I think pretty much everybody agrees that Critical Role, taken at face value, is, in quotes, the best.
Yeah.
Right? Not to everyone's liking, yada yada yada, but all things considered, it's a really good exemplar of a successful D&D campaign, which therefore implies that there are less good and there are less successful campaigns.
Yeah.
So just by its fandom alone, we should be seeing that, hey, no, like, my game sucks, or this is bad, or I should be able to criticize somebody's game for being a bit garbage in this area. But then the moment you want to have those thoughts, and the moment you want to be contrarian, it feels like everybody's game's their own. You can't talk about their game because you don't know about it. Well, okay.
Yeah.
All right, but their game isn't Critical Role, so... And it just seems like there's no... People can't make the leap there between, oh yeah, I know my game isn't Critical Role, so therefore there's stuff I could do to improve.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're talking about D&D, but I think that's the same with a lot of forms of entertainment that have a fandom. Mm-hmm. There's always that staunch loyalty that forces you to be like, no, you can't say anything bad about it. And in terms of Critical Role, like, even Matt Mercer has like come out and said, you know, just because your DM doesn't do, let's say, voices that well, that's not the end of the world. Sure, that's something that maybe he might want to work on in future sessions, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's shit. Now, if you turn up to a session and your DM's like, I guess, like, you speak to some guy, he might have some stuff, I'm not entirely sure. Like, if he doesn't know anything that he's doing, doesn't know any of the rules or anything like that, then yeah, you can absolutely say, yep, that was a shit session. That's not you being mean, but that's just objectively, there are certain, or at least I believe, exactly, there are certain fundamentals that you should be fairly decent at to have like a good session. Now, that's not to say that there aren't people. Again, there's always going to be those outlier situations where some people just literally rock up and just say, hey, fuck it, let's see what happens. But then is that necessarily like a D&D session? Is that a true representation of what D&D means atypically? You know, who knows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I posted about it on Facebook. I made a tweet myself earlier on in the week that said, you know, there are better games and there are worse games. Let's all agree that any given game might be crap.
Yeah.
Right? And the example I've given before is when I turned up to one and it was very clearly wish fulfillment for the two joint co-op DMs that would have just been happy to play the pair of them forever. And that was clearly like great for those two people, but pretty garbage for everybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a session that I ran a one-shot, I think it may have been the second one that I'd ever done, And that was touching on something that you had spoken about on a previous podcast. Mm-hmm. I think it was like a level 18 or a level 20 one shot. I think you were a part of it. It was the like Holy Wars of Zanek or something.
Yeah, I think it's the one we talked about with Simon.
Yeah, and I'm sure that the people that have played before probably enjoyed it in like, oh man, this is awesome. There's like a big war. It's like, oh, there's holy entities and stuff like that. But there was someone that was playing who had never played before. And I just got tunneled visioned on the majority. And so for him, first time playing D&D, going straight in at like a level 20 character, he probably didn't know what the fuck he was going to do any turn. Mm-hmm. And it was definitely like in the moment, I was like, oh, he only ever seems to be attacking. He doesn't really seem to be doing anything else. And it wasn't until afterwards that I was like, oh, yeah, that's because that was like the only thing that he really knew that he could do. So for him, that was like a shit session. But to the others, they probably really enjoyed it. And there's always going to be, it's always just going to be a bit of a balance, really.
Mm-hmm. I think we can put a bow in it and basically say that, you know, overall, their perception of D&D is way more positive. And obviously, it's way more pervasive in popular culture.
Yeah.
What that brings with it is the baggage of criticism, essentially. When there's only a couple of dudes across the country playing it in their basement, no one cares and no one criticizes. Mm. But then once you open the door, then you get arrogant idiots like me making podcasts about it.
Well, I mean, this sort of thing, it's not the first time that this sort of thing happened. It happened with Marvel and DC for the longest time. That was just people that read comics. That was their area. Mm. And then they started making, you know, cinematic universes about it. And all of a sudden, everybody has a podcast about the MCU or DC Comics.
Mm. Yeah, that's a really good parallel, actually. One that hadn't hit me before, but it's probably a very similar curve on the graph of, you know, that exponential curve that probably happened in a very similar time period as well, over basically the past decade.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's only because someone else pointed it out to me, but like, it was literally, it went from, if you read those sort of things, you were a nerd, and now you've got jocks walking around with Captain America t-shirts on. It's like, it's the same thing that's happening with D&D, less so with the jock element, but
yeah.
The amount of times that I've mentioned that I run a D&D campaign and I just get random people that are like, oh, well, I've always wanted to do that, or oh, I've heard of that. Any chance you could run a one-shot for me? It's just slowly becoming like just normal. It's just a normal thing to do. There's still a little bit of hesitation around it, but...
Yeah, there is a little bit there. It's not quite there yet, as three of my closest friends staunchly, close-mindedly won't play, even though I kind of already half set up caricature classes for them just to do this, some goofy, like, this is a taste of what I do spend all my life doing.
Yeah.
And also, when I told my mum, I was like, hey mum, I'm doing this podcast thing, and she's like, well, firstly, what's a podcast, Danilo? Okay, well, let me build that bridge first. And I was like, it's about D&D, and she was like, oh, but who's gonna listen? And then I had to have that discussion and was like, well, hey, actually, it's a lot more popular than you might realize.
Thanks for the swift gut punch there. Let me bounce back from that.
She's like, but okay, well, you know, you might not have a big audience. I was like, well, actually, I'm hoping that there should be an audience, because it's now like giga popular, much more so than it used to be.
Yeah.
So talking of, and it's a good segue, so we mentioned there like Marvel, their rise to popularity happened at a similar time. And one thing I wanted to talk about briefly is D&D as a hobby. So, you know, as a thing people do in their spare time, which again is very kind of high level, you know, even talking about dice rolls at this point.
Yeah.
So a couple of thoughts I had around that were that, again, I keep coming back to this weird duality of pros of the hobby. It can be free.
Yeah.
So a couple of players in my game have, again, staunchly been like, I do not want to spend any money on this endeavor.
Right. Okay.
So everything they've built is straight out of the SRD. So it's literally like a wood elf rogue assassin.
Okay.
So he can just fire up a free account on Beyond, doesn't have to buy a single thing. You know, he borrowed other people's dice at the table and he's like, okay, that's fine. And he's having a super fun time.
Yeah.
But he's like, oh, if I don't have to, I won't, you know, money's tight, 2020, so on and so on, all the usual stuff. And then on the other hand,
there's people like me.
It can also be very not free.
Yep.
So yeah, I just thought that was, you know, because I was trying to compare it to other hobbies, and the one that hits me maybe I'm most familiar with is like Warhammer and 40K.
Yeah.
Which the barrier to entry there is a lot higher.
Mm.
It is absolutely not free, to say the least.
Well, any hobby that you get into can be as expensive or as inexpensive as you want to make it. Not flexing, but I go to the gym. I could literally just work out at home if I wanted to, and then that would be it. That's me working out, staying fit, all that sort of stuff. But I choose to pay for a gym membership. I choose to pay for protein powder. I choose to pay for extra stuff that, to me, makes the experience more enjoyable. Now, it's the same for D&D. You can do it as those two players are, which there's nothing wrong with that. It's absolutely fine. They're still probably getting the same enjoyment as someone mm-hmm. like me who has dropped X amount of money on dice, X amount of money on source books, bloody all sorts of stuff. Like, I've paid like £130 for a wooden dice tray so that I can roll my dice into it. Why the fuck do I need that? I don't. But it feels good when I roll dice in it.
And I must say, it looks very nice
too. Damn right it does. But it's... whenever like people talk about how much money you've spent on D&D or even like Warhammer, it's like, at the end of the day, if it makes you feel happy, if you enjoy it, if that's something that brings you happiness in your life, who cares how much money you spend on it, really? Mm. Like, it's probably more expensive... Well, I mean, it's definitely more expensive if you are a DM, because there's so many more peripherals that you have to pick up as part of that.
Mm-hmm.
For me, anyway, compared to some other hobbies, but most hobbies are just there for kind of socializing, kind of improving something about yourself, because you gain a skill out of it. And that's exactly the same with Dungeons & Dragons. Like, it is you meeting up with like a group of friends. You sit there, you laugh, you joke for a few hours. You eat shit food, typically.
Not if your body's a temple, of course.
Oh, I mean, my body is no longer a temple. If it was, it has been ransacked and defiled.
That's just December.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird when December becomes every month of the year. But this is the part that I really harp on about whenever I'm talking to new people about D&D, or if I'm ever trying to pseudo convert them to playing it. With D&D, the skills that you're getting are your interpersonal skills, improvisation, accent work, acting, storytelling, writing. There's so many skills that you can get from it. It's just such a great hobby. There's so many benefits to it. And yeah, if you want to drop £100 on a set of dice that just shine and say Yahtzee when you roll a natural 20, then be my guest.
I bought a really nice set of metal dice, like Chromatic Dragon metal dice, and because of the way I am, and I'm an idiot, and I do this in other areas of my life, they're just too nice to use, so they just end up not being used, which is, I couldn't think of a bigger waste of money, but they feel really nice and are shiny as hell, so...
Well, there's also the other element of it, where if those dice start rolling natural ones all the time, I mean, your hands are tied. You have to get new ones. There's nothing you can do about it.
Like when you know, websites and companies would do, you know, 3 for 2 on dice and stuff. I know I'm getting better, but I'll often be like, okay, I've got them in my cart, and then I'm hovering over the buy button. I'm like, no, come on, you don't. Why? Because they'll just not get used. Because you roll like 4 dice a session sometimes. So.
Yeah.
And it's just a d20, so you don't even need all the other stuff.
Well, when the world isn't falling apart, I mean, the justification is like, okay, well, I mean, maybe I won't use them. But if I've got players that have forgotten their dice, then I can just lend it to them.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, that makes sense.
So yeah, I used to play 40K when I was a lot younger, in my college days, and that was probably my closest kind of like nerd hobby, to use a bit of a crappy analogy, but it's quite an easy comparison to make for me. But yeah, that was, I don't know, a completely different experience. It might have changed now in the preceding 15 years, but something must be different, right? Because although Warhammer is a lot more popular, it's not quite at, say, Critical Role popular, shall we say.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting thought piece there on why, I guess. And I think, you know, Warhammer is just more niche.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I can't really speak to it too much because I don't have too much experience with it. But the same basic premise seems to be there in relation to D&D, because I've walked past a Warhammer store and I've seen like a group of like 10 people laughing, having fun. I have no idea what they're doing, but it seems very reminiscent. Replace that table in between, in the middle of them with all the miniatures on it, with a table with some pieces of paper and some dice, and you've got basically the same setup. But because I don't know how Warhammer works, with D&D, it's storytelling, and that's if you break down most of society down to like one of the fundamental things that it needs, it's telling stories. Like, we've been doing that as a human race for so many years now. It's just kind of ingrained into our very nature. If something happens to you, you then go to someone else and you tell it to them as a story. One of the main pastimes that people tend to do is go to the cinemas to watch films, because they want to hear strange, exciting stories that they themselves wouldn't live. And so I think that's maybe why D&D is a bit more kind of being pushed into the spotlight.
Yeah, all art is to convey a message, essentially. And that's probably ties in quite nicely with what Ian was saying about how second edition and earlier editions, especially when you're younger, and all those people have now grown up into adults, it was a bit more adversarial. It was a bit like, funnily enough, Warhammer, which is it's combat, right? It's one person against another person. One side wins, one side loses. And that's how D&D used to be played by the younger, predominantly male demographic.
Yeah.
And back when the rules were a lot more mathematically based rather than five chapters on building a world kind of thing. But since D&D has moved away from that, or kind of focused more on the softer elements of it, and obviously the demographic has broadened vastly, it's widened that that audience, and has become more of a storytelling, a medium to send a message, to tell a story, as you said, which is quite nice. Again, it's a weird parallel to Critical Role, this kind of rags to riches thing of just the hobby, let alone of Critical Role, which is quite nice.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, like, if you look at the bulk of Critical Role's like catalog, I'd say probably like 60-70% of it is just RP and exposition and kind of interacting with each other. And then that smaller part is the actual, cool, it's them versus the DM.
Yeah.
Which I would say probably, arguably, is the part that maybe people don't cherish as much, if I was to hazard a guess.
I'm inclined to agree, but it's one of the bits that I like personally, is that, you know, the 60%, as you mentioned, and then yes, you know, technically there should be some sort of balance between the three pillars, but personally for me, and I've said it 100 times before, is that you can't really get it anywhere else, or not as accessible anywhere else. Yes, there's other tabletop RPGs which are going to do a very similar thing, but we're talking a macro, so let's lift it up another level and take it out of D&D and into just tabletop RPGs, is that you can't get that stuff anywhere else.
Yeah.
So I like to emphasize that pillar more, because when you go home and play a video game, that pillar is shrunk down to like 10%. So you can make up for it in tabletop RPGs. So the first half, we've kind of talked about it meta. In a way, we've talked about it as a hobby, as a thing people can do, and as a thing people enjoy. Let's step to the side and let's bring it back to the game of specifically D&D 5e and the macro of running a game.
Yeah.
So we've talked about the macro of the hobby, but now let's talk about the macro of a game, a session, a campaign. So I think we both mentioned earlier on about long form campaigns, as I call them.
Yes.
Versus short form or one shots, which in my experience are rarely one shots. So I am probably very similar to you in that my imagination runs wild and very, very, very quickly does not fit into 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sessions, because I've built this whole thing up. And the other thing that is becoming even more apparent is the game I actually ran last night is, as mentioned, it's quite a short you know, 5 to 10 sessions maybe.
Yep.
But it's actually probably going to be longer. But there's a, what I would consider a simple dungeon in it. I tried to hit all three pillars. So there's a bit of a dungeon crawl in it at one point that's literally in kind of like abandoned mines.
Mm-hmm.
And I would consider it relatively simple, right? There's no loop backs. There's no, you know, fog gates. There's no pull this lever and another lift gives you a shortcut.
Yeah.
It's not designed like a Dark Souls level. It's very, quite linear. There are a couple of branching paths, but it's literally like a classic room 1, room 2, room 3, room 4, room 5.
Yeah.
And there are things to do in those rooms. You could put it on a ruler, essentially. Even still, the first floor of that dungeon has taken 2 sessions in of itself. So I have no idea how... in fact, I do have a bit of an idea, because I've looked in the past at a couple of, you know, published, you know, homebrew...
Yeah.
One-shots. And the dungeons, typically, they don't actually have dungeons. What they have is a building, a mage's tower that might have a ground floor and a first floor.
Mm.
And that's pretty much it. Which I find kind of funny that the game is called Dungeons & Dragons and one of the more popular ways to play doesn't have any dungeons in it.
Yeah, let's get rid of that that rather large chunk of D&D. Yeah, it's a weird one. I mean, most of my one-shots that I've run, I've kind of cheated in the sense that whilst it works as a one-off session, I've managed to set it in the world of my campaign so that I can play on that area a little bit more if it is somewhere that I particularly enjoyed. But similar to what you were just talking about, the only one shot that I can think of that was truly just a one shot was something that I did. I think I had an hour's prep time, and it was just two people, part of like an invading force. A patrol had gone out to an area, but it had gone quiet and they didn't hear anything from them. And so they had to go and investigate it. And so they literally just investigated a small clearing with a few tents, one kind of fairly dilapidated building, and then that was pretty much it. And they went in, they found that everybody had been killed, they killed what was there, and then they had to make their way back, and that was it. And that literally took like 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, running it, whilst it was fun because there was like a horror element to it and there was atmosphere, it felt kind of, I guess, hollow.
Mm.
Whereas like going into a dungeon, there's so much fun that can be had with that. I feel like that's one of them. Well, I mean, it's like half the reason that you play Dungeons and Dragons.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I struggle with one shots.
Yeah, so that's probably why we've both gravitated towards long form campaigns, which ties in beautifully with what you were saying earlier on about let me bring in that goblin from 50 sessions ago. I maintain a list of, I call it the credits, of the NPCs that the characters have met, because A, I know they're crap at taking notes, and B, there's an awful lot of them, so they're likely to forget them. So when they come back and they go, Danilo, who the hell is this? I can go, well, actually, you met this person in session 34.
Yeah.
My thought process there of, you know, this first floor of that dungeon taking, well, actually, it'll probably take about 3 sessions in total, what amounts to 3 rooms. So it's a session a room. Is the velocity is the same for the long form campaigns, and we are currently at 49 sessions, and the players have done or are about to nearing the end of kind of chapter 3,
right,
out of potentially 7.
Damn.
Yeah, so my original estimation was, I think the first campaign of Critical Role was like 100. Oh no, how many episodes in the first?
Well, so the first campaign is 115 episodes, but they started when they were like level 12, level 11.
Oh wow, okay. My podcast that I listen to, Not Another D&D Podcast, their first campaign was, I think, 101 in the end, if you include the epilogue, something like that. So my headcanon was always like, we should be done, if we keep up this cadence, by about 100 sessions in.
Yeah.
Which I guess is still technically possible, depending on, you know, how much the players stick around.
Yeah.
But that number's a little bit scary now I say it out loud. And now, for a number of reasons. One, shit, that's a lot more content I got to do. B, am I going to meet that deadline, basically? Or am I going to have to, you know, is my budget used up and I'm going to hit 100 sessions and be like, oh, sorry, boss, I need another 50 sessions to to really see this through.
Yeah.
So a learning experience for me is trying to gauge player interest, and we're all at a place in our life, luckily, where things are relatively stable, which might be surprising given but luckily enough, very, very fortunate to find ourselves in a relatively stable position. So I'm hoping that the longer form campaign can play out for us. Now, I don't expect you to go into too much detail about our Dungeons, Dice and Deeds campaign, nor do I want you to, because that would spoil the fun.
Yep.
But from what I understand, it's, again, quite a long burn, quite a long form.
Yeah, so I'd done one-shots, enjoyed it, and through the process of doing that, and as I said, kind of creating these towns, cities, places, had started envisioning a world where these cities would exist. So the first one-shot that I ran, Battle for Stonehaven, that is a place where I think either your character or Tim's character is actually from. I think it's your character. Mm-hmm. And so once that started happening, and it kind of got things percolating in the old brain box. And so I started kind of coming up with just the world. And as soon as I started doing that, I was like, okay, if I run this campaign, one, it's going to be long. And two, it's going to be more focused on story, because it'd be a podcast. It was always going to be for a podcast, but with the caveat of, you know, if that starts interfering with our enjoyment of the game, then bin that off. And so it massively helped by setting those expectations with everybody else first, of being like, just so you know, by getting involved with this, you are making a commitment for a year, possibly 2 years. And luckily, everybody is dead keen with that, and it's going well so far. But similar to, I think, what maybe some people have mentioned on this podcast before, I had an idea of where it was going to begin. Almost immediately, I knew that this was going to start with a, hopefully not to trigger anybody, but it was going to start with a terrorist attack.
Mm-hmm.
And that was going to spark a potential Cold War. And then I knew where it was going to end. And then so far, all I've been doing is just kind of putting down little lines to connect everything. If you ever look at my notes for the campaign, I mean, one, you'll probably break down and cry because they don't make sense. But in my head, I'm like, cool, I know where everything is going, but it's just trying to figure out like ways to connect everything. That's that's what I'm not struggling with, but certainly that's what the bulk of my planning is, I would say.
Mm-hmm. It's tough to do it in a way that makes sense in universe.
Yeah.
That's the problem. You can string anything together however you want, but if the players go, why the fuck is this guy here when he was on the other continent 2 days ago, then there's no point in doing it because it doesn't make any sense anymore. Or if you're playing some weird goofy campaign where everybody teleports around, then it makes sense. But in most typical fantasy settings, it's hard to string it together in a way that makes in-universe sense. And that's why I've stayed away, out of kind of willful ignorance almost, of doing too much of the kind of political and like geographical borders.
Oh mate, you've done yourself a favor there.
A lot, you know, all the world building tips you see online are like, put your capital cities together, who's warring with who, and have they got the resources? Maybe this town has got wood and this town has got water and they need each other's resources, and that's how they've got this alliance. And I'm just like, man, I'm gonna fuck that up. Don't let me do that, because it's gonna be bad if I do that. And I know that the moment I would do that, players would be like, but why? Or I've accidentally put a forest near the city that's got water, and they go, yeah, but they got a forest there down low, so why are they fighting it? Oh, I don't know. I've not got a major in geopolitics.
That sort of thing is certainly difficult. I like to think that I've kind of distilled the conflict between the two major cities that we've kind of been in, which is Luxem and Terrasol, to the base component enough that it's fairly easy for players to just be like, cool, they're the questionable bad guys and they're the seemingly good guys, which makes it a lot easier. If it's just like two opposing ideologies, most people can just instantly get on board with that.
Yeah.
And because of your surrounding environment informing your creative decisions, it was basically designed to be cool. Luxem is like the right wing and Terrasol is like the left wing. And that's basically it. Mm-hmm. But now I've got to deal with somehow orchestrating a war that you lot are now kind of going away from, which I suppose makes mm-hmm. things easier.
Oh man, that makes us sound like right balance. Like we've lit the match, thrown it into the haystack, and then just gone, yeah, peace, see you later, guys. Which I know is what we've actually done.
I think you literally did that.
Oh, now I feel bad.
Nah. But even though it's going to be difficult, the fun part of it is, for me anyway, as like a storyteller and a DM, is how does this now affect the world that you guys are still traveling through? Like, although you're not directly interacting with it, there's going to be ramifications. It's going to affect the world and the cities that you go to. So it's going to be fun, but it's difficult. And props to anybody that has like politics and that sort of stuff at the core of their campaigns.
Mm-hmm. I agree completely. Like anyone who can do it in a way that is enjoyable and makes sense and has political intrigue, which is more than just there's spies, watch out.
Yeah. I mean, at that point, you are essentially becoming a writer for a show. You know, you're writing House of Cards or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I could definitely not be anywhere near other than these guys are blue, these guys are green, and blue people hate green people, and green people hate the blue coloured people, and there's sometimes spies. go players. But again, it depends on the players, right? Some people want that, and some people don't. So it would be a wasted effort, maybe, to do that for my players. And so in that respect, I guess I'm lucky. Well, they're lucky that I can't be bothered to do it either. So at the moment, there's a lot of, they're almost like bubbles of chapters. Each chapter exists a little bit in its own bubble. There are wider like implications, like you said. So, you know, they will meet people on the other continents. There will be, oh, did you hear about that attack over there? That kind of stuff is going to happen. But there's not really like the classic, you know, like the Witcher map, where there's big swathes of red on the map that, you know, you can't push that border forward. Not yet. There may well be something like that down the line, but that is certainly not my comfort zone.
Yeah.
To be frank. And my internal geography of trying to find a location in the real world is pretty good. I have a pretty good intuition for directions and finding places.
Yeah.
But in terms of designing a world, it's garbage.
Nothing yeah. Yeah, it's because as I say, like I came up with these two cities and I knew that I wanted them to be pretty close to each other, and then that's like as far as I got. And so what I found myself doing is just kind of creating the continents and then putting rough placeholders for cities and stuff like that, and then just filling in information as and when people have needed it, because once again it's in my head, but when I look at my notes I'm like, that's a horror film right there. But yeah, in terms of like distance, I have a big issue with because I don't know how far things should be from each other.
And
environments as well, like if I think you guys have got like an area coming up that is like a coastal town / city, but in my head it was swamp like and then I had to do a load of research. I'm like, are swamps even able to be near coastlines? Are they only inland? Are there rivers that connect to them? And I'm like, Jesus god damn, I just wanted it to be a swampy city that's a bit spooky.
I'd know that feeling only too well. And you know, well, probably it would be me in your example. I'd be like, why is there a swamp here? You know, there's always going to be a player that's like, well, hang on. Or the worst thing is they go, well, hang on, why is there a swamp here? Oh, there's some naughty magic somewhere that's twisting and tainting the land. And then the DM's there like, nah, man, I just wanted a swamp.
Yeah. I mean, I'm quite lucky that like George, Tim and Cy comparatively are all pretty new to D&D, and so they don't question a lot of decisions that I make. But I think for the most part, as long as it is an engaging area, there's atmosphere, you fill it with a decent amount of detail, people can overlook the gaps in knowledge of, like, a swamp being where there shouldn't be a swamp.
Yeah.
Although I have looked it up and it does make sense.
Okay, good. You can sleep easy now, and so can I.
Yeah, I can rest.
I do relish, I mean this in the nicest possible way, but basically turning my brain off from that thought process when I'm a player, so I don't, you know, I use playing as an excuse to be like, thank goodness I don't have to think about this kind of stuff anymore. So I relish not having those critical thoughts, and I use it as a time to not look too closely at that kind of stuff, because you're going to find cracks and, you know, the stitching that the DMs that to put in there to stitch it all together, and then it is no fun for anybody. So I use that as a time to go, okay, do you know what? I'm just going to take everything on face value, because 9 times out of 10, that's what the DM wants anyway.
Yeah.
So we can all just move forward together.
Yeah. Becoming a DM is certainly, I would say, informed me as a player just to be more receptive to ideas and, like, not question things as much. Though becoming a DM, I play maybe like once every 6 months now. I'm like fishing and begging for people to run one shots just so I can play again.
Get that hit, get that fix.
Oh man, that fix. Don't even know what it tastes like anymore.
Yeah, it does give you that perception of just take it on face value and just like move on. And I think with a lot of newer players who've just gone straight into it, there is that inclination to be like, oh, he mentioned a rock on the floor. What's that rock? Why is there that rock on the floor? Where's this rock come from?
Yeah.
Man, you're in a cave. There's going to be rocks.
I mean, I've definitely shot myself in the foot a little bit in this area somewhat. Just purely because I have started introducing things earlier on, and then there's like a payoff later on, and in particular time as well. Our particular campaign, the players have died a few times, and that's possibly in part to do with me having run a one shot before, and one of the earlier quests there was like a pseudo ticking clock where if they had taken multiple rests, the child that they were trying to save would die. If they hadn't, sure, they might have been a little less prepared, but the child would have been alive. But because of that, it's now set this like weird paranoia inside of them. And so now it's just like, nah, just got to keep going, mate. Nah, just keep, nah, push in. Doesn't, what, big dark cave? Nah, it doesn't matter. It's fine.
I think it's better to be that way than wanting to take a rest every 2 seconds.
That is true. So. That is true. But yeah, it's kind of shot myself in the foot a little bit, but it also means that for them as players, they are much more engaged because they're like trying to understand the world. They're trying to see if there's any details that they've missed, which for me is a lot of fun because either A, they're going to find something that I have hidden or placed there, or B, I'm just like, I mean, no, that's not it at all. But sure, you keep thinking that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I need to probably drop in a few more little nuggets myself of more obvious threads, because that's, I wanted to say it earlier, like it's something I struggle with, is it's so easy as the DM to be like, no, you idiots, this is a guy you met. And I have that memory crystal clear in my head of that whole interaction. Who was there? The words they said. And I think to myself, why the hell have I remembered that? And it's so easy for players not to.
Yeah.
And that's still something I struggle with, even just beginning to comprehend, like such a huge difference in what players and DMs find important. And I, you know, as a player in your game, I'm just as susceptible to that. And it's just something I find so interesting and weird that the perception is just so vastly different despite playing the same game and sitting at the same table. I have this crystal clear, yes, you spoke to that person for 3 hours and they told you their whole life story. And the player's just like, who? Sorry, who?
Yeah. I mean, I obviously not to throw accusations, but is that something on the DM's part of not making that character memorable enough? Is that something on the player's part of not being engaged enough? Who's to say, with you, I'm not throwing shade, probably your players. But again, in our campaign, I'm quite lucky that we don't really have that, because quite recently there was a reveal of a gnome cleric who had, I think they met back in session 2, and we're on session like 26, 27 now.
Mm-hmm.
And when they first met them, the kid that had died was her son, and she was very distraught, and they did some botched roles, and she kind of like locked herself away. And before they left this town, they decided to go there and just quickly visit. And Ulrich, for whatever reason, was convinced that she was like doing some like bad juju, was like trying to bring her son back or something like that, but he had no proof. And everybody else was just like, you're being an arsehole right now, like, just leave her alone, let her grieve.
Yeah.
And now 25 sessions later, or 26 sessions later, and almost like 9 months later, they have now gone back to that same town, have found her house and gone in there and found like a hidden door where there was elements of necromancy, and the satisfaction of seeing Tim / Ulrich being like so vindicated in his beliefs and having that kind of payoff and him remembering that interaction, it's quite a drug. It's quite addicting to be able to deliver that to someone that has shown participation and engagement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's probably, you know, six of one and half a dozen of the other for me, but I'm a big proponent of talking about memorable characters. A lot of people are normal and mundane, and yes, some of the more major NPCs might be flamboyant, or they might hold positions of power, but that's not always memorable, right?
Yeah.
Someone being in aloof Bellend isn't, there's another person in the way of the character's adventure.
Yeah.
Sometimes, rather than anything too exotic. Is there anything you wanted to specifically talk about regarding macro?
Yeah, I mean, we've kind of covered it a little bit, but just in terms of planning in general, like a campaign, for me personally, people have different ways of going about it, but I certainly found it a lot easier of going in for the larger story elements and the larger city points than going the other way. Like, I, for example, still to this day, I've got, like, you lot are on your way to Monilum, a fairly big dwarven city. I've got an overall understanding of how that place works, how the political structure works. But if you were to ask me what the shops there or what the NPCs there, having a clue. I'll figure that out when I get to it.
Yeah. That mirrors me quite closely too. Except this current chapter they're running through, I'd actually run through, you know, halfway previously. So I had a couple of things to fall back on there, but I found a flowchart of the overarching story, and then each one of the characters pretty much has their own flowchart I've put together of the first couple of blocks of their backstories, and then it flows into, well, if they make this decision, or if this thing happens, then this other happens, and then a couple where they cross over, and this, that, and the other. And that's how I've planned the next 5,000 sessions of my never-ending campaign. But yeah, I said before on a podcast, that's what I find fun, I think. A lot more fun than almost the moment-to-moment, oddly enough. And that's probably where I fall short sometimes of... Maybe I'm better at it now, but definitely in the past of being like, oh man, Danilo doesn't... Let's just move on. Like, Danilo doesn't care about this small little thing that everybody's fixated on right now. Can we all just move on to this cool twist I've got planned in?
Yeah.
Down the line, and that's a personal struggle for me in trying to balance that and be like, no, let me give the micro the care it loves, because I'm just so fixated on the macro of this would be cool if this would happen, and this would be cool if this would happen, and like your Monolum example of this town will be cool if it's embedded on the side of a valley
and
overlooks this glade at the bottom. Okay, cool. What's there? And I had to push myself to be like, okay, well, maybe there's a couple of shelves, and maybe the bottom shelf is the housing, and the middle shelf is like the shops, and the upper shelf is like Bel Air, and is where the nice rich people live, because they're physically and literally above those below them, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I think most of the time you can start with the macro, and then you can always filter down to the micro anyway. And most of the time, In my head anyway, the macro is there's certain plates that you're constantly spinning, be it the overarching storyline of your campaign, any kind of mini story arcs that you might have, and then the character arcs, and those you're just, they're spinning, and just every now and again, when story dictates it, or when the players have driven the narrative in that way, you just got to quickly run over and spin it a little bit more, just to put a little bit more emphasis on it.
Yeah.
And everything else you can kind of just fill in as and when you need to. At least that's how I look at it.
Yeah, and before you eventually serve that plate to the players,
yeah,
and you dish it out in front of them and say, there you go, that's your dinner for tonight. I can put that plate in the dishwasher now.
Yeah. Where did this analogy come from?
I don't know, but I'm really invested. Yeah. And then you get the tip and you pay the bill and there's the whole thing.
Oh, mate.
There's the whole thing there. All right, so I think we're pretty much there, and this session has been a bit of a palate cleanser.
Yeah.
To continue it, just when you thought it was over, it ain't.
Yeah.
That metaphor is going to keep giving.
Oh god.
A bit of a palate cleanser to the kind of, yeah, we talked about emotions in the last episode, but it's very easy to, you know, this is now a theme of a bit of a higher level. We had quite a few earlier episodes were around the roles and, you know, how to build a character and what makes a good player, the moment-to-moment gameplay. So it's quite nice to talk about these high level topics. And today we've talked about D&D as a hobby and its perception in popular culture and the good things that brings, and maybe
not so
it opens
good.
Itself up. Yeah, it opens itself up to vulnerabilities and the opportunity to drop a few of those spinning plates. That's it, it's still going. I'm going to keep it going.
Yep.
and then, world building, which I love to put my hands up and to build those long-term payoffs. And I personally find it frustrating that it takes me so long to get to those points. And literally, I'm the only one in control of how long it takes to get there. Cool. So, unless there's anything else you want to mention or talk about?
No, I think we've done a pretty good job there. I mean, we're probably stopping and I'm like, oh man, I've still got like another hour's worth of stuff that I want to talk about. Oh, and just in time for the cat to come in as well.
That's it. Well, that's a good stop point as any. But that's, you know, hey, if you do have that thought, we will have a session two, and I'm toying with the idea of having season one be the first pass and then season two being, you know, round two, essentially, or approaching them from a slightly different vector.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, thank you very much, Nathan, for coming on, and enjoy your DM holiday as much as I will enjoy mine over the Christmas and New Year period.
I can't wait.
Otherwise, if anyone has any thoughts or comments on today, you can find me on Twitter at @Danlow_DND. And Nathan, if there's anything you want to plug, now's your chance.
Sure. I mean, you've got me on The Briggsy on Twitch, and then Twitter, I think it's also The Briggsy. I've been on the internet long enough that I've managed to keep things fairly uniform.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, those are probably the two main places to find me, either recording D&D or just talking about D&D pretty much.
Yep, and you can find us both in our, as mentioned at the start, Dungeons, Dice and Dudes, which unfortunately, or fortunately, will continue to be streamed, I think, in the new year. So I think drastically changes.
Yeah, more than likely.
Filled with enthusiasm there, Nathan.
Hey, it's trying a DM and then also running a stream. It's tearing my brain in half.
I imagine it's a huge pain in the backside, and I count my lucky stars every time I start, and all I've got to do is put a playlist in Spotify and then I'm done.
Oh god, sounds like heaven.
But yes, do check us both out in our DM and player capacities and Dungeons, Dice and Dudes. And thank you all for listening, and good night.
Bye.